Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Tired of the everyday? We know a hotel that's ready to unwind this weekend. Book hotels with spas in the Hotels.com app. Find your perfect somewhere.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 9th of March, these are our main stories. Efforts to get humanitarian aid into Gaza by air and sea have intensified, as the UN says a quarter of the population in the Palestinian territory is on the brink of famine. A police officer in the Indian capital Delhi has been suspended after video footage seemed to show him kicking Muslim men while they were offering Friday prayers in the street. The UN's nuclear watchdog says its specialists have heard several explosions near the Zaporizhia power plant in Ukraine, suggesting fighting with heavy weapons. Also in this podcast, as Hollywood prepares for the Oscars on Sunday, there's just one question preoccupying fans of the Barbie movie.
Are we going to get a Barbie too?
I mean, we'd love to. Yeah, we're always talking about it. I think right now we're just so happy this week to be celebrating Barbie's success and Barbie at the Oscars this weekend.
We'll hear from one of Hollywood's most powerful women. After warnings this week that a quarter of people in Gaza are on the brink of famine, the US and its allies have stepped up efforts to deliver aid to Palestinian families. On Thursday, President Biden announced that the US military would establish a temporary port on Gaza's coast. On Friday, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, announced the creation of a maritime corridor to deliver aid by sea. The Deputy Director of Operations at the UN Relief Agency, UNRWA, Scott Anderson, welcomed the plan.
We hope it will make a significant difference. I think that, you know, there's some details we need to work out on the logistics of the sea route. How will it be delivered on the beach? Who will do further distribution? Things like that. But we welcome this because we know there are people starving and we need to get them aid as quickly as possible.
But this man in Rafah said what Palestinians really need is an end to the war.
Instead of telling us they will build a port to help us, stop providing the weapons they throw at us. All these American weapons are killing our kids and killing us wherever we go. We don't need aid from them. We need them to stop the killing, stop the death. Wherever we go, we find death.
So, talk of a port and a maritime corridor, but are they the same thing? I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Wera Davis.
No, these are completely different things. They just happen to have been announced 24 hours apart. I think, to be honest, Joe Biden wanted to announce a ceasefire. That ceasefire between Israel and Hamas didn't happen, and he wanted to announce something. So they've got this plan, and it's a very far-fetched plan, and we don't know how it's going to work, to build a sort of port that would bring not just aid, but perhaps even building materials to help with the reconstruction of Gaza in future. But that's a couple of months down the line, I think. What we've heard from the Europeans and the Emiratis and others is this so-called maritime corridor. And again, this would be a boat, initially one boat, that would try to take pre-checked aid from Cyprus towards the coast of Gaza. And as the guy from the UN, UNRWA, said there, how it's going to land, how it's going to be protected, how you're going to keep 1.5 million desperately hungry Gazans away from these boats as they try to offload their aid on shore. Nobody knows, because there'll certainly be no foreign troops, no American troops, no British troops, no Emirati troops in Gaza. But both of these announcements seem to be, I don't want to use the word far-fetched, but they're not going to help really with the amount of aid that's needed. You know, 100 trucks a day at the minute make it into Gaza. It's nowhere near the 500, 600 trucks that are needed. And it's really opening this land border, even without a ceasefire, and allowing more stuff in, more aid in from Israel that would alleviate the desperate humanitarian situation in Gaza.
Because both these efforts are also over the heads of the Israeli government. And the Israeli government is already saying, well, don't think any aid's going to be getting along this corridor that's been announced without security checks and things that are bound to slow it up.
Some people say it gets the Israelis off the hook, because as the occupying power, as the invading army, they have an obligation under international laws to make sure that the people in northern Gaza do get the adequate aid and help they need. Now, Israel says it will allow in as much aid as is possible, and it blames the United Nations and other agencies for being slow with it. In turn, people like the World Food Programme say that Israel is actually turning away certain aid consignments, and therefore only about 100 trucks a day are getting through when a lot more is actually needed.
Wera Davis with me from Jerusalem. So how does Israel see itself being involved in this new initiative of a maritime corridor with aid going from Cyprus into Gaza? Ofir Falk is a foreign policy advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
All of the aid will be scanned and security cleared, and we'll be able to get more trucks in. Israel's already enabled thousands of trucks of humanitarian aid, of food, water, medical attention or medicine.
Of course, Mr. Falk, it could be argued that this maritime corridor, these US airdrops, would not be necessary had more aid been getting into Gaza by road convoys. And Israel stands accused of obstructing the flow of that aid into Gaza.
Right, so that's absolutely ridiculous, of course. A lot of the humanitarian aid would reach the civilians if Hamas was destroyed and wouldn't be stealing humanitarian aid that Israel has been able to go in.
But Julian, you asked a question, but I just wanted to break in at that particular point. Israel says it's now rid northern Gaza of Hamas. So that really isn't an issue, Hamas interfering with the distribution
actually,
of aid.
Actually, Israel never said that. We've rid North Gaza of Hamas. There are still a number of Hamas terrorists there, and we're still fighting there. We're still taking them out, mopping out. It's true, there aren't brigades there. We've been able to dismantle 18 or even almost 19 of the 24 Hamas brigades, but we haven't gotten rid of Hamas yet.
Just returning to that accusation of Israel obstructing the delivery of aid by road
into
Gaza.
I told you that's ridiculous.
President Biden says that Israel must do its part by allowing more aid to enter the territory. That's the president of the United States, your closest ally.
Right. We highly respect and appreciate all the support that the president has provided Israel. We also appreciate his wise words on October 18th when he said that if Hamas steals the aid or diverts the aid, that will stop immediately. On October 18th, the president said that. Nevertheless, Israel is enabled and has enabled thousands of trucks. I don't know how many trucks you've enabled, Julian, but Israel has enabled thousands of trucks of humanitarian aid into Gaza. And honestly, we don't need anybody to prompt us to provide humanitarian aid because ethics is in our DNA.
Okay, on Tuesday this week, the World Food Programme said it attempted to reach northern Gaza with food supplies, but was turned back at an Israeli Defence Force checkpoint. That is a specific example of the blocking of aid into Gaza by the Israeli Defence Forces. Your response to that?
I'm not familiar with that specific incident, but I can tell you that Israel has enabled thousands of trucks with humanitarian aid to come in, and we'll continue to enable that. And we've coordinated with our American and Cyprus allies to get aid in through the maritime route that we've enabled. And we're trying to get thousands, or as much humanitarian aid in as possible after it's cleared and has security clearance. And that's the goal.
It is reported that 16,000 trucks have entered Gaza since the beginning of this conflict, or about 105 a day. But that is far below the average of 500 commercial trucks that had entered Gaza daily before the fighting began. So you're right on thousands, but it is still far short of what is required necessary.
Julian, I don't know where you get this 500 trucks humanitarian aid from. That's not an accurate number. It certainly didn't come from Israel. At any rate, we're at war, and we're going to destroy Hamas and free our hostages.
Ophir Falk with my colleague Julian Marshall. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine is the biggest in Europe. It's been under Russian control since the start of the war 2 years ago. The UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, which has been meeting in Vienna, says it now has serious concerns about safety there. Bethany Bell is our correspondent in Vienna. I asked Bethany what exactly the IAEA had been saying.
Well, it says the situation at the plant is very precarious. It's got specialists stationed at Zaporizhia. It says that they're continuing to hear explosions very close to the facility. There has been shelling there, which has brought down power lines, and the plant has lost all external power 8 times in the last 18 months, which means it's forced then to rely on diesel generators to do crucial things like cool the fuel in its reactors and to avoid catastrophic meltdowns. So this is really, the IAEA says, not the way a nuclear power plant should be run. And the Board of Governors issued a resolution saying that they were gravely concerned about this.
So there are issues here about the safety of the plant, obviously the supply of electricity, but also this idea of fighting in that part of Ukraine now seems to have come a bit out of nowhere.
What the team at Zaporizhia of the IAEA has said, it's heard multiple explosions in recent days, and suggesting, in their words, that heavy weapons were being used close to the plant. And this is something that the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, has warned repeatedly of the dangers posed to the plant by the ongoing conflict there. And he says that both sides have accused each other for the shelling near that region. Mr. Grossi has said that both sides have to help to reduce the danger of what he called a potentially severe nuclear accident, because he said that would recognise no borders.
Now, they've also had talks with President Putin in Russia this week. What came out of that?
Yes, Mr. Grossi went to Sochi in Russia. He met Mr. Putin. We haven't heard that much about the actual content of the talks, but Mr. Grossi described them as frank and professional. He said that he told Mr. Putin that nobody stands to gain from a nuclear disaster and that we must do everything possible to prevent it.
Bethany Bell with me from Vienna. Officials in the Indian capital Delhi have suspended a police officer after a video went viral in which he appeared to kick Muslim men offering Friday prayers on a road. A senior official said they'd initiate disciplinary proceedings against the policeman. Here's Anbarasan Etharajan.
The video triggered very angry reaction on social media, with several people, including opposition political parties, demanding strict action against the Delhi police officer. The incident prompted a protest by angry locals who blocked traffic in the Inderlok area of the Indian capital. Footage on social media showed the official kicking and slapping the men, telling them to leave the area. Residents said the prayers were not causing any traffic disruption. The latest incident came amid accusations by activists that Muslims are being discriminated against, especially after the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power in 2014. The party rejects the accusation.
It's Hollywood's big night tomorrow as we get to know the winners and losers of the 96th Academy Awards. Oppenheimer leads the way, but Barbie, with its 8 nominations, was the big winner at the box office. Warner Brothers, the company that made Barbie, is riding high on the movie's success. The co-chairman and co-CEO of the studio's motion picture group is Pam Abdi. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, went to Los Angeles to meet her.
Here.
Warner Brothers made Barbie, the biggest grossing film of last year, mainly in the UK. Greta Gerwig wasn't nominated for a Best Director Oscar, and Margot Robbie isn't up for Best Actress, which has got to hurt if you're Pam Abdi, one of Hollywood's most powerful women.
Yeah, of course it does, you know. Of course I want to see all of them get recognized. They deserve it.
Do you think the Academy voters are sexist?
I don't want to say that they are sexist.
You guys are clearly not doing patriarchy very well.
But Abdi, the co-chair and CEO of Warner Brothers Motion Picture Group, does worry that not enough Academy voters actually watched Barbie. The Academy has worked to diversify its membership in recent years, but it's still a predominantly white male organization.
And we're really grateful that it ignited audiences around the world, and it's made $1.4 billion and has smashed so many records, just, you know, Greta's records, box office records, Warner Brothers history records. So we're super grateful for all of that.
Margot Robbie now has a key to the lot, an old Warner tradition revived by Abdi and co-chair Michael De Luca.
Marilyn Monroe is presented with a key to Warner Brothers studio by executive producer Jack L. Warner.
And he found a couple of the old keys on eBay, actually, and we bought them, and we're now going to make it a tradition. Margot's is actually Marilyn Monroe's key.
There are tours.
Yes.
You're giving me my tour.
Yes, I am.
What can you tell me?
Isn't it a beautiful lot?
Yeah, it's great.
I love it. I love walking around the lot.
Abdi and De Luca were hired 2 years ago with a mission to restore the studio to its glory days.
You're here, you've been brought in with fanfare. It's like, you guys are here, you're going to take this movie studio back to its glory days.
Yeah.
What went wrong?
I think the business became about, you have to make only franchises. It's franchise, and you have to make superhero movies, and I think that's what's gone wrong with the industry.
We've got one hope. All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here.
But Warner Brothers created its own problems. This year's Oscar favourite, the Oppenheimer director Christopher Nolan, spent most of his career at the studio. But he walked away in 2020, furious at the decision to put movies straight onto the studio's streaming service.
So do you think Warner got that wrong when it came to Christopher Nolan?
I can't judge what they were doing. I think they were trying to adapt to whatever was going on. You know, we were in the middle of a global pandemic. You know, I can only speak
to... But they lost their biggest star.
Yes.
Part of the strategy is to lure in big names. They'd like Nolan back. Tom Cruise is already signed up to make new movies with the studio.
Tom had made amazing films at Warner Brothers, and he's been working at Paramount for a long time, and we wanted to figure out a way, how do we do that?
When you're speaking to these directors, are you promising them, look, your film is going to be out in cinemas first?
Absolutely.
We're not going to put it straight on a streamer?
Absolutely. We are a theatrical studio.
We have a track record for winning Oscars. Birdman, The Big Short, The Revenant. What's your recipe for Oscar glory?
Directors.
Always the director.
Taking the best director.
But for many, there's only one question.
Are we going to get a Barbie too?
I mean, we'd love to. Yeah, we're always talking about it. I think right now we're just so happy this week to be celebrating Barbie's success and Barbie at the Oscars this weekend.
And that report from Katie Razzle in Los Angeles. Still to come.
Goku, you think you've got enough firewood there?
Yeah. This should last us a while, don't you think?
The creator of one of Japan's most popular comics of all time has died.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Struggling to keep up with your toddler? We know a hotel that'll keep them entertained. Book family-friendly hotels with pools in the Hotels.com app to find your perfect somewhere.
With DoorDash, dash that delicious whenever a craving hits. Dash that late-night burger and that lunchtime lox. Dash that post-workout protein and that poke bowl. Taste of the Tropics is on now. Get 30% off orders of $20 or more. DoorDash. Terms apply.
A report into a British Army spy who operated during the Troubles in Northern Ireland has said more lives were probably lost than saved by his involvement. The agent, known as Steak Knife, was embedded in the Irish Republican Army, the IRA. He was Freddie Scapatici, a bricklayer from West Belfast, who worked in an IRA unit that interrogated and tortured suspected informants. The interim report has concluded that British security forces failed to prevent some of the killings in an effort to shield their own agents. This from our correspondent in Belfast, Jennifer O'Leary.
For decades, spies were the state's eyes and ears inside the IRA, a secret army that executed informers. The IRA's chief enforcer was Freddie Scapatici. The dark twist being he was also a prized army intelligence asset, codename Steak Knife. He is not identified in the report because of the existing government and security policy of not naming agents. He always denied it, but revealed his true character to BBC journalists after his double life was exposed in 2003.
Off. It's caused enough problems in this house. Take yourself off. All that stuff on the TV and everything else about us.
Among today's interim findings from Operation Canova, a seven-year investigation into his activities and the role of his handlers is a brutal equation. Agent Steak Knife probably cost more lives than he saved. John Boucher led the investigation before being appointed Chief Constable of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. He said the agent should have faced justice.
And I'll say Freddie Scappaticci should have been prosecuted for offences, and he was not prosecuted. And in my view, that is something that forever victims, certain victims, will be regretful about.
Now dead, Freddie Scappaticci was a spy who got away with murder, shootings that were signed off by senior IRA leaders. Today's report called for an apology from Republican leaders for the IRA's brutality. Northern Ireland's First Minister Michelle O'Neill, the first Republican to hold that post, was asked if she would apologise.
I am sorry for all the lives lost during the conflict, without exception. Regrettably, the past cannot be changed or cannot be undone. Neither can the suffering, the hurt, or the political violence of conflict be disowned by Republicans or indeed by any other party to the conflict.
During the Troubles, the fate of those accused of giving away the IRA's secrets became a form of public spectacle. Bodies were dumped in ditches and alleyways, and grieving families left with the stain within Republican communities that they'd buried a suspected tout. Like Shauna Moreland, who was just 10 years old when her mother was shot dead. She said if her mother was an informer, she wanted to know why the British state failed to protect her.
I think if she was informing, she had handlers, they would have known she was missing. There was many more IRA informers at the time that would have been given information on it. I think she could have been stepped in and saved.
Kevin Winters is a solicitor for several other victims' families.
The stigma for the tout or informant runs very deep in Irish history. That stigma extends to the next of kin and the next generation. Indeed, if proof were needed of that, we need only look around this room today. There aren't any families. And that, to my mind, is very telling. Families still feel uncomfortable about being in the public domain in relation to these matters.
Operation Canova is not over. A detailed report is yet to come, but today's developments have shone a light into dark corners of the so-called dirty war between British intelligence and the IRA.
Jennifer O'Leary in Belfast. The security forces in northwest Nigeria are trying to rescue more than 280 children kidnapped from a school in Kaduna State. Let's get the details from Myani Jones.
The authorities say that they are throwing everything at trying to find these children that were abducted just 24 hours ago. They were sitting in their morning assembly on Thursday morning when armed men rode into their school compound. Now, it's two schools, a primary and a secondary school, right side by side, just separated by a line of trees. And apparently the assailants rounded up these children and took them into a nearby forest. Some of them managed to escape, as well as some of the teachers. They say that they then tried to get local militias, vigilante groups, to go after the children. Unfortunately, they were unsuccessful, and one of the community members that went after them was killed. We've also now gotten news that a teenager that was a pupil at the school was also killed.
Let's go back now to events in the Middle East. And while the war's been very much centred on Gaza, violence in the occupied West Bank has also been surging since the attacks on October the 7th. More than 400 Palestinians have been killed there as Israeli forces search for Hamas militants. 15 Israelis were killed there over the same period. The UN says children account for a quarter of the Palestinians killed. Our special correspondent Fergal Keane reports now on the case of 10-year-old Amar Najjar, shot dead last Monday as he went shopping with his family.
They knew Amar Najjar from his beginning in the village of Burin. Now they were burying him. 10 years old, a schoolboy going shopping with his father. He was killed by Israeli troops. So the factions have come to claim him as a martyr. The PLO, the communists, Hamas, bear him to his grave, wrapped in their flags. There's a single bullet hole in the windscreen of the family's van. Amra's blood has dried between the front seats. Eyewitness Jamal Najjar said the village was quiet as the family's minibus came down the main street.
He wasn't talking to anyone. He stopped after he saw the soldiers in front of him.
Amr's father, Muhammad, described the moment of his son's death.
They shot directly at us. So my son Amr was killed immediately. He was not injured. He was killed immediately as he was shot in the head.
Amr's little brother Ahmed was also there.
He was shot, then he fell and I ran away, Ahmed says. They were shooting at the bus. They broke the glass and the bullet passed through the window and hit him. In a statement to the BBC, the IDF said it had faced a surge in terrorist attacks since October 7th, but that it does not target non-combatants, including children. It said live fire is only used after all other options have been utilised. On the death of Amr Najjar, the IDF's response is read by a colleague.
During IDF counter-terrorism activity in the town of Birin, a number of suspects hurled rocks at the soldiers, who responded with live fire. A short while after, a report was received regarding a Palestinian miner who had been injured. The circumstances of the incident are under review.
The UN says children account for a quarter of the 417 Palestinians killed in the West Bank since October 7th. 15 Israelis have been killed there in the same period.
There is no accountability. Nobody will hold them accountable. They are protected even.
Khaled Kuzmar, director of the International Defence of Children Palestine, says soldiers act with impunity and should be held to account by the International Criminal Court.
So I believe that if there is an international accountability system in force, I'm sure they will change their mind. I'm not sure that all of them will stop, but at least I know that there will be something different than now.
Burin is overlooked by Jewish settlements built on land confiscated from Palestinian villagers. Settlers have been filmed attacking villagers, destroying their crops. The military has been accused of repeatedly siding with the settlers, of failing to protect villagers. Since October 7th, settler violence has escalated, according to human rights groups, with over 600 attacks, creating what Amr Najjar's mother Salam says is a living nightmare.
I don't let my children out of the house fearing they'll kill them, and I go get them from school so they don't get killed. And then my child's destiny was to get killed here in the town. As much as I try to protect my child, he's gone from me.
That report from our correspondent, Fergal Keane. To Japan now, where the creator of one of the most influential comics of all time has died. This is Akira Toriyama, the artist behind the mega hit Dragon Ball. He was 68. His manga art is appreciated around the world and is also found in cartoons, films and video games. Our arts correspondent, David Sillitoe, looks back at his career.
For millions, the adventures of Goku with his black, spiky hair in Dragon Ball was part of childhood.
Goku, you think you've got enough firewood there?
Yeah, this should last us a while, don't you think?
The creation of Akira Toriyama, it was more than just another cartoon. Toriyama's work was, for millions around the world, their first introduction to Japanese manga and anime. One reflection of his importance is that his death has been marked by official statements from the governments of both Japan and China. And in JapanCraft, a manga store in London, the fans were arriving to mark this moment.
My first manga, when I was little, my cousins gave it to me to read.
It was exactly as I wanted, like a little boy, just like pure action, that kind of thing.
I have watched this when I was young.
So Dragon Ball was the beginning of it for
you? Yeah, for sure. I have been forced to watch it, but at some point it was nice.
I have a lot of artist friends, and it's hit all of them really hard.
It means a lot to me. I've always appreciated Toriyama's expression in his comedy.
Toriyama was an artist who largely avoided publicity. He did appear occasionally in his own comics, but only in the form of a robot, Toribot. However, his fame is global, especially after COVID helped supercharge interest in manga. JapanCraft's Jeremy Bart.
When the COVID started, the average of percentage of consumptions for the UK markets increased by 400%. So the demand went way higher.
Akira Toriyama, an artist who helped supercharge one of Japan's most potent exports with Goku. A spiky-haired, super-powered cartoon radish farmer.
Our arts correspondent, David Sillito, reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker. The producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Tired of the everyday? We know a hotel that's ready to unwind this weekend. Book hotels with spas in the Hotels.com app. Find your perfect somewhere.